there are a number of factors that I think made our search very successful very quickly, which is that our contact in China was someone who was knowledgeable, and then our area was very small, so it was a very rural area. So you're not looking in a, you know, a metropolis of 10 million people. You know, this is a very rural village area with, you know, several thousand families. So it's a very small community.
Yeah, the finding location was definitely a big contributor in our success, I think. And the fact that it was accurate. And it was a relatively small town. You know, I've talked to a lot of people about how to search because, you know, people have a lot of questions about it. And I know there are people now who will go search for you and do that as a business countrywide. I always tell people your best bet is really finding something, somebody very, very local. It's the same as searching in America would be. You know, if I were looking for somebody who had not kept their baby in my town, I would want to ask around in my town. Like, I'd want somebody who lives here who knows who to ask and knows who, you know. I always think that a big underutilized place to search is at elementary schools because most of our kids, or even middle schools, most of our kids have siblings who are older or younger who have stayed in China with their families. And, you know, if there was a mom at school where my kids go to school who had been pregnant and then did not raise her baby, everybody would know. You know, I think people tend to think that China is very exotic and very difficult, but in a lot of ways, China is still just a place with people going about their lives. So if you think about how you would search here, or where, if you couldn't keep your child, where you would leave that child, I think it makes the search a lot more logical. And having someone really, really local who is comfortable asking around and asking a lot of questions makes a big difference.
So for example, you know, our contact was in the same kind of area as Lena's family, Lena's birth family. And so it is not difficult for that person to just in their own network of friends figure out, oh, I think there's seven families that this could be applicable to. And if you think of your own small suburb, you know, our suburb that we live in, you know, we know virtually, you know, I would say we can get access to virtually every family in our suburb.
Through several degrees of separation.
Through one or two degrees of separation. And if you just had a focused person who was willing to be discreet and ask questions, you could figure out within 3 months who had given up their child for adoption just by having discreet conversations. And that's the type of process that we followed to get someone in the, you know, try to identify the area in which we believed that Lena was given up to the orphanage system, and then identify a contact there who would have either a personal relationship or could easily develop a personal relationship with the targets.
Yeah, with the targets, with the birth family. Another thing that I think is important is a lot of people like the idea of going and hanging up posters. In our situation, I think that really could have been a deterrent to having Lena's family come forward. The fact that we had someone contact them privately, they were very afraid when we contacted them. They were very nervous. They thought that they were being scammed or that somebody was going to ask them for money to keep it quiet. And so I think that being able to approach them privately and so that they could come forward and have contact with us, you know, on their terms made a big difference too. It was in her family's comfort at that time.
Yeah, and I don't know what, and so I don't know what, how, you know, I don't follow the kind of adoption news the way that Amy does, but my impression was that, you know, that Lena's birth family, it, you know, we identified them, and then it was still a long time before they were willing to initiate person-to-person contact with us. And so there was quite a long period of time where all communications occurred through our local contact. And if you kind of think of it from the birth family's point of view, if you were in their situation, that's what you would do too. Because of the language barrier, because of the economic barriers, because the fact that, you know,
they broke the law.
They were engaged and possibly could be engaging in illegal activity just by having a communication. You want to kind of deal with known quantities. So I've always been interested and a little skeptical of kind of the public posting pictures and stuff, because I think that's as likely to scare off people who you would want to talk to, in addition to helping identify people who want to find them. So I don't know. I just don't know. I just don't follow close to that.
Well, that
I would say in a rural area, maybe not so much in a big city, you may have no other choice, but in a rural area, I think going discreetly is probably to your benefit.
You know, we were just very lucky that, I just have a better understanding of Chinese culture than someone who's not Chinese American, one. And two, that our local contact was just very effective. And so I think the advice I would give is searching directly, you know, an American searching directly by themselves in China is
difficult.
Very difficult, and it's going to require a lot of luck. But American who marshals resources to identify people in China, and there are many, the right types of people, and able to form a real relationship with them that is more than transactional, right? A relationship built on trust and honesty and the right thing to do. You know, the Chinese people, the local contact that we work with, that person simply felt that, you know, it took a long time for us to explain to that person why we would want to have contact with Lena's birth parents, and that person was initially focused on healthcare reasons, in case that Lena had some sort of disorder that needed some sort of medical history, and it took a several month long process to discuss with our local contact that's important. But in addition, there are psychological benefits. And we've done the research to know that there are psychological benefits to having that sort of contact. And that's not something that a Chinese person is going to be familiar with. But as soon as they're briefed on that, they understand that at a common sense level, just like everybody else would. And so, you know, working hard with our local contact and the translator to explain these concepts and say, this is more than just trying to, you know, get access to a blood sample. You know, this is because we want to develop a lifelong relationship. And the local contact then immediately understood the moral importance of this. And the local contact believed that this was a cool thing that person could be involved in. And also important for the birth family, and was incentivized to try to help us. And so, that's the level of relationship that it took several years to develop. And once it was developed, it kind of ran on its own. And so, I think that, you know, an American living in Arizona is never going to have knowledge of some rural village in Western China. And they're just not going to have sufficient knowledge. And the only people that have the knowledge sufficient to identify the birth family are the people living in the village where that birth family is located. And you got to go out there and find that person.
So That's do you correct. Think the fact that you are Chinese American had any bearing at all on your ability to make those kind of contacts? Did it play a role? Do you speak Chinese?
Yeah, I do. I speak Chinese at like a third grade level.
Okay.
And
but,
the way that I would explain it, it is helpful, but it is not necessary. And so I think the most important thing is to have kind of a very deep level of kind of emotional and cultural awareness. So you can't get anything done in China that is complicated or difficult with spending. You know, you can get a lot of easy things done in China. I mean, you can go buy cheap shoes and you can go on a sightseeing tour. But getting anything complicated done in China requires a level of time investment and relationships the time investment is related to the relationship. And you have to just understand that you may go there several times and meet with the local contact one or two times, and it will fail. You can have numerous telephone calls that are hours long, and those telephone calls result in what you would see as failure. But the Chinese are culturally, as a culture, it is what matters most is sticking to the relationship, keeping to work at it, and being present. And so if you have to go have dinner for 4 hours with your local contact, that's what you have to do, even if it results in no real new information. So, you know, so that is, so you just have to have an understanding of how do complicated, difficult things actually get done in China. And they get done by a combination of developing a real relationship, but exhibiting actual effort so that the other person knows you're exhibiting effort on the relationship.
I gotcha. So suffice it to say that I think, if I may generalize, that Americans are, we kind of tend to move through the world with a sense that if we put our shoulder to the wheel, things are going to happen, and they're fairly well going to happen on our terms and on our timing. And it takes, it sounds like, a real suspension of that, an understanding that this is a much more subtle long-term and really should not be, cannot be overtly transactional, as you said earlier. In other words, who wants to feel like somebody's just there to get something out of them and then leave?
Right.
Especially
intimate. I think a lot of people who are searching want to just pay someone, have them go handle this and be done. And I think that's a big part of the reason a lot of birth families aren't found. I think you can't do that. But in our case, for example, our local contact has actually found another birth family for us and for another family that we knew from the same orphanage. But then communication broke down between that family and the birth family. And we then lost contact with our local contact because it made us lose face. It made him lose face with the other birth family. He's no longer willing to help us anymore. So I really wish that we had managed that situation on our own instead of putting him directly in contact with that adoptive family, because now it's a resource that's lost to us, you know?
So did that adoptive family decide, I mean, we're not naming them, and I don't want to press you to discuss another family, but I'm just curious, did that other family decide we don't want contact, or try to negotiate terms that were scary to the birth family, or?
I think what happened in that situation, you know, without getting into anybody else's too many personal details, they had a very easy to locate birth family based on the circumstances of their child's finding, and so it was very easy to locate them. And I think it all happened very quickly without this period of time it took us to really wrap our heads around what we were doing. Like, when we were searching, it took me, you know, Robert is talking a lot about his relationship, but I was the one mainly working with the translator, and it took about a year of phone calls and stuff before we found them. So there were a lot of times where I had to sit and reflect, do I want to stop with this amount of information we've gathered, or do I want to go forward? And you can make that decision at every point, and in my opinion, until you find the birth family. But we had committed in our family that if we found the birth family, that we're in this for the long haul. It's in Lena's best interest. There are other people on the other end who we as Lena's adoptive parents are the gatekeepers while she's a child of their contact with each other. And we are just very aware of that responsibility. But also, I think it took us a long time to find them. So we had a lot of time to reflect and think about what did we want contact to look like. And in the case of this other family, it happened practically overnight. And I think that they just really weren't prepared for the reality of what that was going to look like. And they just shut it down. And I know a number of adoptive families who found birth families, and that happened. You know, it's an incredibly emotional and stressful experience to be all of a sudden sharing your child with another family. Mm. And I think there's a lot of, you know, it's not easy. For adult adoptees who are in reunion, there's actually like a cycle of emotions that adoptees go through. And when I found that, I found an article about that cycle, I discovered that I was experiencing that same cycle myself. You know, at the beginning, you're very excited. And then after a little while, it becomes very overwhelming. And I think it took me personally about, I don't know, a year or 18 months to really feel like my life was back to normal. We met the birth family several months after we found them because we had already scheduled a trip to China at that time. We hadn't done DNA. We weren't positive it was the right family, but we thought it was. When we met the birth family, it was just an incredibly stressful day. We only had one day with them. And they didn't know, first of all, they didn't know if we really had their child. They still thought it was possibly a scam at that point. And then when they met us, they thought that we would see them the one time and they'd never see her again. And so that experience for us of seeing them and then taking her away from them when they're just people who obviously really care about her, you know, it was just an overwhelming emotional experience just for me. And it's not even my birth family, you know.
Mm.
So I have incredible sympathy for other adoptive families who are going through this. It's not an easy situation to manage. And it's a choice by us on a regular basis that we choose to keep contact open and we choose to not be jealous of their place in Lena's life and in her heart. And we choose to visit them, even though there's a lot of emotional fallout for all of us while we're there and when we come home and leading up to that trip. And it's a huge level of commitment that a lot of people don't think about. And then when they find the birth family, I think it can be overwhelming. And a lot of people, even domestic adoptees, when this happens, sometimes people withdraw and shut down.
Which is you know, that's a personal choice and that's totally fine. But it takes a lot of time, energy, and money to maintain that relationship. It is a significant adjustment in how you choose, how you choose to raise your child. And it's something that, we have gotten way more out of it than we put into it, but there's a cost to the benefit.
The experience of meeting Lena's birth family and building a relationship with them is largely, almost on every level, is about learning to trust each other and showing them they can trust us. You know, when they first met her, they thought that would be the only time they would see her in her entire life. And so we had to say to them, no, we want to see you again. We want to talk to you. And there are times where I really don't want to have contact with them because it's emotionally draining for me, the buildup, even to a phone call. I feel like, it's a big responsibility. It's stressful. We have to get a translator involved. It's not an easy process, but I have to have a schedule set so they know they can count on us not to disappear with their child. And we have to know that they care enough about her to put up with us. You know, they're basically a countryside family who has had a family of foreigners dropped in the middle of their lives. They didn't ask for that. You know, they had no idea that Lena was going to go to America. So they really had no clue. And they didn't believe it when our local contact told them. And, you know, I think for them, we really do have one of the best case scenarios you could have in that they've welcomed us. They're accepting of us. They don't have any information about what foreigners are like. And they tolerate us, you know, making cultural mistakes. And, you know, they've really accepted us into their family in a way I think that would be hard for a lot of rural families to do. So we really, you know, we're thankful every day for how well this has worked out. And it's certainly not the way it works for everybody.
Yeah. And then the other thing I would say is that Amy was talking about, you know, her emotional adjustment after finding the birth family. They also went through a pretty serious emotional adjustment. It's been, I don't know, 5 years since we initiated contact. And the first year of contact, you know, it was very stressful because, you know, people were feeling each other out. They weren't sure what to say on the phone calls. You know, every phone call would end up in crying because they were,
stressful.
It was very stressful. But now, you know, the relationship has developed to the point where, you know, I would characterize the relationship as the type of relationship you would have with a close, extended family member, like a close aunt or uncle who lives on the other side of the world, and you visit from time to time. And it's a very comfortable, warm, loving, familial relationship. We're blessed to have the ability to go travel there and visit them in their village. And when we go there, you know, Lena, you know, views it as her second home and just runs around the village and chases all the chickens and that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's a very, very, very wonderful thing that Amy has really driven, and it's really created great benefit to our family and to Lena.
How did, let me ask a couple of just nuts and bolts questions.
Sure.
They didn't know that their child had been internationally adopted, which is not uncommon at all.
Right.
That birth parents don't have this information. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened here? They had an over quota child. Do they have other children? Do they have other daughters?
So Lena has an older sister and a younger brother, and they live in a rural area. So it seems from talking to people that, first of all, the year Lena was born, which was in 2006, there were very heavy enforcement of family planning rules at that time. So she had an older sister who was already with her family. And at that time, I'm not even sure if she had been a boy, if their family may have had to pay a very large fine for that, but they probably would have done it. When her younger brother was born, family planning had been loosened up quite a bit by that time. And in her rural area, they will permit two children if you pay. So they did have to pay for her younger brother. But I don't think it was as much as if he had been born several years earlier. I think things have just changed. Things have relaxed a lot in China in that period of time. When she was born, you know, I think it's just a very typical situation. And, you know, if you've ever read Wanting a Daughter, Needing a Son, Kay Johnson's book, studying, you know, birth families in China, you know, they needed a son. Lena's father, there's not a lot of men in his family, and so he really needed someone to carry on the family name for cultural reasons, and they needed a son in their village. It's very clear that there's a lot of favoritism towards boys and, you know, sons in general. And I think, you know, I think it's a difficult decision that they made. I know that they didn't make it lightly. They were very sad that they lost her. Her mom told me that she cried. In China, they stay in bed for 30 days after a baby is born. And she told me that she cried the entire time.
So did your paperwork, before you knew any of this and you were just looking at your documents, did your paperwork have an abandonment narrative? She was found at the railway station. She was found in front of the health center. Or did
you? Yes.
Yes, it did. Okay. So you only...
The place she was found was actually just the place she was born. That was what was on her paperwork.
I'm curious about a couple of other nuts and bolts things. One is the DNA test. At the point where you were asking for confirmation, was the birth family nervous at all about a DNA test? How do you do that? Is the test performed in China? Is the sample taken out of the country and performed here?
So how we did it 5 years ago is very different than how we would do it now. Now there are, you know, American companies like 23andMe and Ancestry where you can do DNA testing and compare it relatively cheaply and easily. We knew we were meeting the birth family, and at the time, our thought was we'll collect hair samples, and then we were going to have it run through a special lab that does, like, paternity testing. As we were in China, I heard from a friend who had done similar testing with a possible birth family in China that the hair samples were very inaccurate and hard to test. So then we panicked because this was several days before we were going to meet Lena's family, and tried really hard to figure out what could we do. And we found a lab that would allow you to use a regular Q-tip, like a cotton swab. And there was a certain procedure on their website as to how to do it. You basically had to let it completely dry and then seal it in a paper envelope and then send it in. And so we were traveling. We spent several months in Asia at that time. We were traveling, and then we did this test on the Q-tips and sent them when we got to Hong Kong to the lab that would accept them on Q-tips. Now, I do genetic genealogy, which is DNA birth parent searching for domestic adoptees, and I would suggest that anyone doing it now would travel with a 23andMe or Ancestry DNA test kit and do it that way, because if you're meeting a possible birth family, that would then put that birth family's DNA in a larger database so that if it doesn't match, it may match another adoptee who would also be in that database. That's how I would do it now. Mm. At the time, we didn't have time to have a DNA test sent and tested because our local contact was not in the area where Lena's birth parents were working. They were working in a different province, and he had talked to them by phone but hadn't met them in person. So it was too complicated for us. In general, if you were from a distance, I would suggest definitely do a DNA test in advance. Because I know of people who have met possible birth families and then it ended up, it was not a DNA match. In our case, Lena looks so much like her birth father and they have a very unique look, that I think we were fairly certain that we had found the right family.
Or closely related.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah. But based on the paperwork we had, like the dates and stuff matching up, we were fairly certain. Yeah.
Right.
And I think just having been through that experience, I would, if we could go back in time, I would never introduce my child to someone without DNA evidence, knowing what I know now about the emotions of this process. You know, she was very young. She was only 4.5 or 5. But, you know, especially with a child who is, you know, a teenager or 10 or 11 years old, I wouldn't introduce my child to a possible birth family without a DNA confirmation, if at all possible. Mm. Just because it happens too often that you find the wrong family. I know too many cases of that happening.
So now, what is it like now? It's been 5 years. Lena was 5.
Four.
So does she really have any much concrete memory of not knowing her birth parents? Or is her sort of, you know, worldview on this that she has two sets of parents and that's something she's pretty much always known about herself at this point?
I think she doesn't remember not knowing. Mm. I think she remembers us telling her about her birth family a little bit. She was still pretty young. And I think she remembers our first meeting maybe as much from pictures as her real memory. I think that, you know, we try to keep regular contact with them. We talk on the phone about every 2 months, which seems to be a good amount on both sides. It seems to be a good balance for everybody involved. And then we've managed to go back and visit them about every 2 to 2.5 years, which I think is interesting because then Lena is meeting them again at different developmental stages. And so each visit has been a very different experience for us. The first visit we went, we did not go to the village because her family wasn't comfortable with anybody knowing about us. By the second visit, they had told people in the village because we had told them, we don't mind if people know, like we're happy to visit. We'd really like to see your home. We'd like to meet, Lena's grandmother. You know, we would like to see that. And so, and that first visit to the village was on our second trip was definitely hugely nerve-wracking for them. I think it was a lot of pressure. But by this most recent visit, we visited them this year, it was very comfortable. It's clear everybody in the village knows who we are. They know why we're there. They know whose child Lena is. They understand what's going on. It's a small enough village that there's no secrets.
It's like a celebratory atmosphere when we arrive, which is very similar to other experiences I've had when I visit rural China, you know, hey, this is a new interesting thing happening, and the whole village will come out and say hello, and all the kids come out and play. And the wonderful thing about a small village in rural China with only 300 families or so is that everyone knows each other, and so it's just there are villagers who know of Lena who aren't related to her, but are, you know, understand that she's also a village girl, and they treat her that way.
Yeah, and also I think it's great for Lena to have the opportunity to meet her siblings at different ages. You know, the siblings don't participate as much in the phone calls that we do regularly. We've more recently started using WeChat, and so we do occasionally send videos back and forth between us, and we can see her siblings. I think her sister will probably get a smartphone in the next couple years, and that might open up some direct communication between the two of them. They don't seem to have a problem with language, speaking different languages. They just start to play, and the last time we were there, Lena's brother, we asked Lena's brother who was his favorite American friend, and they said our older daughter. He said our older daughter's name. But then we asked Lena's older sister, who's your favorite American friend? And she said Lena. And they have little inside jokes, and they play. And I really think that there may be some, there's always going to be some emotional issues, I think, between Lena and her birth parents, because they're the ones who chose not to raise her, you know, that chose that she would leave their family. So I think that there's going to be some emotional baggage there for the rest of their lives. But I don't think that same baggage is going to happen between Lena and her siblings. And I think that might be the real long-term relationship that really, really she carries with her in her life.
Has Lena posed the question to you? Here she sees there's another sister, a brother. Has she asked, why me? Does she understand? Why give me?
She does. Lena understands about, we've talked quite a bit about the one-child policy, and we've talked about, you know, the law in China and having to pay a fine, and we've talked about the cultural issues around having a son and why that would be important for her birth parents, with her, you know, and she knows that, but I think that her understanding of that is different at different ages. So on one of our visits, there was a moment where she really had a real emotional breakthrough and understanding what it meant. And she said to me, you know, it's not fair that I can't live with my mom and Baba. It's not fair that my brother can and my sister can. And, you know, it was a real moment where we all cried about it together. Like, it isn't fair. And it is a really crummy thing that happened to her in her life. And, you know, the roll of the dice of being the second daughter is, you know, that was her fate, and it sucks, and she knows it. But I think she's also a kid who is really, she kind of rolls with the punches pretty well. You know, she has moments where she's really processing that, and other moments where she's just happy to play with her brother and sister and happy to be with her mama and Baba when we visit. So, these are things she's going to have to come to terms with as she gets older. All we can do, as the adoptive parents in this situation, is keep the door open between Lena and her Chinese family, and, you know, let her know that any relationship she has or any love she has with them doesn't threaten us in any way, and that her truth, knowing all of the truth about how she came to our family, doesn't change her place in our family, and it doesn't change her place in her birth family. That, you know, choices were made that were out of her control. But we can all tell that her parents love her very much. Her Chinese parents love her very much. And then we all want the best things for her. And, you know, sometimes in life, bad things happen. Sometimes in life, people make choices we wish they didn't make. And that's just a theme that we talk about with her quite a bit, I think.
Yeah, and we all make choices in a social context. In fact,
right.
I think the notion of choice in this whole question is an open one. Do you know? I mean, when you're making choices with quotation marks in a social and societal and legal context, that by its very nature limits your ability to choose, it's an open question about whether it's really choice at all. And as she gets older, I think, and other adoptees get older, and they have, as you say, developmentally a greater understanding of all of this, I think maybe the nuances, you know, of all of it become clearer. And so,
right. Well, let me say to that point, there is something that I think is very different about our family and other adoptive families, because we have this level of openness and real understanding of what was going on in her family that led to the choice that they would not raise Lena, is that I think a lot of times adoptive families create a fairy tale about the birth parent and about the story of how the child came to be adopted in their family. And I think in our situations, because these are living, breathing people, they're people we care about, and they're people who we know, we can see that sometimes they don't make good decisions, and sometimes they make decisions based on their circumstances. But there's no fairy tale about it. There's no, like I've had people say to me, like, oh, her birth mother must be so amazing because she's the most amazing child. Well, Lena's amazing, and her mother is a lovely person, but she's a person. She's not a fairy tale protagonist. She is a person who has a difficult life and has, you know, sometimes makes good decisions, sometimes makes bad decisions, and they're just regular people. There's no fairy tale in it for us anymore. They're like any other people you know. Like, you know your relatives, and you know which relative sometimes makes bad decisions and which relative is generally making good decisions. And I think our relationship with her birth family gives us a level of insight into, you know, the messiness of life that a lot of adoptive families gloss over.
Yeah, I hear you. The sort of mythologizing of the birth mother and the assumptions about what may or may not motivate her can, and I understand exactly what you mean, can be.
Oh, and I'll say to that too, Lena has been in the village, and she sees that in the village many families have two children, and many families have younger daughters. So it is also the case that her family made a decision for themselves that not everyone in their same circumstance made. Now, there could be reasons each family made a different decision, but I think that her understanding of the complexity of her circumstances will be different than someone just saying one child policy and so you had to leave your family. I just think that it's going to be a really complicated thing for her to integrate and understand as she gets older, but I think it's the truth, and I think it's easier to reconcile one truth than 100 possible fairy tales or imagined worst-case scenarios. So we will work with her, and she will grow up trying to reconcile her understanding of the truth of her circumstances.
How would you feel, have you thought about the possibility, I mean, that she may at some point decide this is not a relationship she wants to continue?
No, it's absolutely something I've thought about. You know, I read a really great book about open adoption, which is much more related to domestic adoption, but I find it really applicable in our experience, which is a book called Hospitious Adoption, and I think it's the author's last name is Gritter. And he talks about at different stages in an open adoption, different people, different members of the triad are the ones who have to display hospitality. And at this point in the relationship, it's on us. It's on us as the adoptive families to keep that door open, to invite her birth family in, to have a relationship with us and with Lena, and to make sure that Lena knows that door is open and that we love her family, and we want as much contact between all of us as possible so she can have a relationship. As she gets older, the responsibility for that hospitality will be different. It's going to be on Lena to decide if she invites her birth family into her life or not. It will be her birth family's decision whether or not they keep the door open to her as she becomes an adult. You know, these are things that we can't predict. All we can do is the best we can do right now to keep things open and to have a relationship. I have thought, though, that, you know, if there's a time where Lena decides to shut down conversation with her birth family and stop having communication with them, I think it would be very difficult for us to completely close the door on them too, because she's choosing not to have contact. Because at this point, there's a relationship between the two couples, between our family and Lena's mama and baba. Like, we have a relationship, a familiar relationship with each other, in addition to her relationship with them. And we've spent a lot of time building their trust with us. It's hard to imagine that we would ever completely close the door on them if she chose to stop contact.
Yeah, if Lena at the age of 17 says, you know, I don't want to do these calls anymore or whatever, I'm not sure that we would stop the calls. I mean, it just would be calls between me and Amy.
To me, this is a conversation that's about whole families, especially if we're talking about birth parent searching and now the reality in the Chinese adoption community of adoptive parents making the decision to search while their children are very young. The children are not making the decision. The children are not being asked to consent. The search is being conducted. Well, however, whatever, people have various views and attitudes about this, and adoptees are very divided about it, the ones that I've interviewed. But as it's happening, it seems to me that you can't negate the fact that what you're saying is true. The four parents in this situation have established a relationship that is in and of itself independent. So I can understand what you mean. I mean, it would seem cruel to cut that off. I'm sorry.
And we enjoy going there.
You know,
it's just an enjoyable thing. You know, so, you know.
But also, can I say something to what you just said? You know, I've talked to a lot of adoptive parents who want to just know how to search. And I feel like a lot of people haven't really done a lot of research in what open adoption looks like. You know, they just want to do the search because, you know, it's like the show on TV where your long-lost people come together and you're hugging. And isn't that a lovely ending? That's really just the beginning. You know, the search is such a small part of what has gone on with our family. You know, the commitment to doing what is best for Lena as she gets older, and the commitment on all sides to ride through difficult moments and look past cultural mistakes, and you know, that is something that takes a lot of work, a lot more work than searching ever takes. I have people say things to me like, I will search for my daughter's parents, I'll search for her parents, and I'll just keep that information for her, and when she's an adult, she can decide if she wants to have contact or not. Well, to me, that's really problematic, because at that point, you've prevented your child from having a relationship with her birth parents as a child. You know, there's something to be said for Lena developing a relationship at different developmental phases with both her siblings and her birth parents. You know, that will really inform her choices when she's older, and has a better understanding of the choices that were made that led her to be adopted. She'll have had experiences with her birth family where she understands there's affection there, and she sees their heartbreak when we leave. And she's had the chance to be children with her siblings. You know, she's had a chance to play and build a relationship like that. Also, you have to remember that there is a family on the other side, and if you search for them and you mess it up, the responsibility for that is on the adoptive family. You know, the weight of responsibility in maintaining that relationship and making sure that we keep that door open for Lena as she gets older is not insignificant. It's a huge level of responsibility. And things will happen. People might ask for money in a really awkward way. You may do something to make people lose faith and they feel like they can't talk to you anymore. You have to have, on all sides, have a level of commitment. I wouldn't open that door. I would search unless I was 100% committed to the long haul of doing what is best for every single person in this relationship, and that includes her birth family.
And I think that the birth family community needs to understand that while the relationship, you know, is you know, every relationship is mutual, every successful relationship is mutual, you just have to have an understanding that as the American in the situation, you are going to be putting in more resources than them. And so you are the one who's going to have to travel to China. You are the one who's going to have to pay for the phone calls.
Translator.
You are the one who's going to have to identify a good translator that is willing to work with you over many years. And that translator is socially gifted enough to maintain a comfortable relationship with the Birx family, but also an appropriate professional distance. You know, you are the one, you know, the American Birx, it is, the onus is on the American Birx family, the American adoptive family, to provide those resources, because the people giving up their children in China don't have resources.
Right.
And they just don't have, and they just don't have, they don't have money or the education or the know-how to pull any of this stuff off.
So,
you know, if you're just going to go in there and say, oh, it was their fault, you know, that's really not a realistic,
it's not a realistic view
of how the world works. You know, a family, you know, working in a rice paddy in rural China is not going to be able to identify a translator who can deal with the situation.
Or have any cultural competence dealing with foreigners. Like, there's no reason we should expect Lena's family to have any cultural competence dealing with us. Because why would they? You know, they're Chinese. They live in China. They only know Chinese people. So the flexibility on our end is significant.
So since you did raise the issue of resources, I'm gonna ask this very nuts and bolts question, because I think it's part of it and it's important. Did you pay your local contact? Did you pay your translator? If somebody's gonna undertake this, what should they be thinking about financially?
So this is what I tell people. The search itself doesn't have to be super expensive depending on how you do it. In our case, before the Birx family was located, the only expense we had was paying our American side translator to do the phone calls for us. And that was, $200-$300 over the course of a year. Now it has become more expensive for us because as a family, we've committed to going to China fairly often. The translated phone calls are maybe $50 every 2 months. It's really very reasonable. But we have visited China several times, and I think our entire family, all four of us went together. The second trip, Lena and I traveled alone because plane tickets were extremely expensive and Robert couldn't get off work the amount of time we needed. And so that was still fairly expensive. There's just a certain baseline amount of money that has to be spent to do the visit. We don't give money to Lena's family. I know there are circumstances where that might be possible. I think where it might be an expectation on the Birx family side, we do compensate them for their expenses while we're there as a gift at the end. I think we give them money for like food that they've paid and maybe traveling from where their jobs are to be in the village. And we give them some gifts, but it's all fairly, it's like if you were going to visit family for Christmas. So that part is not particularly.
Yeah, and so a gift of, for example, you know, $500 at the end of the trip to compensate for the inconvenience of feeding us for a week and those sorts of things, that helps kind of, you know, it makes the trip easier and it makes the experience easier for them. But we are not.
Because they're not wealthy people.
They're not wealthy people. And it does impact, just like it impacts our lifestyle to travel to China every 2 years. It impacts their lifestyle.
They have to stop working
to
spend a week with us.
Spend time with us. And so that helps them. So there's expense, and it's not insignificant, but it's very worth it. You know, it's an expense that you know, we'll maintain the rest of our lives.
One more thing to that, though, expense though. I think too, people really need to think through before they do a search, what are you willing to spend money on and what aren't you willing to spend money on? During our search, I suspected, having read a lot and, you know, Kay Johnson's work and other people, we suspected Lena had a younger brother in China. And I had hard feelings about the fact that he was likely getting more family resources. And I had said to Robert, like, I don't care. We're not paying any money for that son. We're not paying for him to go to school. We're not going to give him any money. Like, if they chose him over our child, I'm not going to support him. I think now, very different. They've never asked us to contribute to their children's education or anything, but I think that we would probably be open, as Lena's sister gets older, to maybe helping with some kind of vocational education or something like that. And the same with her brother now. You know, I know him. He's a real person to me. He's not just the boy who was chosen over my daughter anymore. You know, he's Lena's brother, and I care for her siblings as much as I care for my children in a lot of ways. I want to see them be successful, and I want to lessen the gap of opportunity between our children and their children. But I think you really need to go into any search having thought through the complexities of what you're going to find on the other side, and what that means for your family, and what level of commitment you're willing to make, and that you have a translator who has the skills to help you negotiate that with them.
So the things that people need to keep in mind, you know, if they're successful, first of all, in terms of the search, is to be effective. You know, using money is not equivalent to being effective. You know, being effective is finding someone who is willing to develop the relationships with the birth family that make contact possible, that make verification of the birth family possible, and make contact with the birth family possible. It is a relationship exercise. And the second is, if the birth family is found, the resources need to be expended on things that enhance the relationship, like an effective translator that is willing to work with you over many years and travel with you. That is an expensive resource, and that is it. So in terms of the money that we set aside, you know, several thousand dollars are set aside for that translator. So, you know, those are the things that enhance the ability to communicate and create a relationship. A translator who's willing to check in on the birth family, when we're not there, you know, that is the type of person you want to identify. And those people are not difficult to find, but they also need to be vetted.
They're special people. You know,
they're compensated for it and well compensated, but you know, they're not doing it just because they're making a lot of money in Chinese terms.
We're just so indebted to our translators. The whole thing would not be possible without such excellent translators that we had.
Oh, I mean, I don't see how it could be possible. I mean, the great thing about your experience and your willingness to share it is that these are very concrete. This is very concrete guidance that is so valuable that I think people kind of only, if they think about, they sort of half think about. And
right.
So
yeah. Or they think about it like a fairy tale. Like, they don't think like there's nuts and bolts. But, you know, the fact is, Lena's family has asked us for not an insignificant amount of money. And that had to be handled incredibly delicately, because if we caused them to lose faith, it could destroy our relationship. And we didn't end up giving them the money they asked for. And that was due to the amazing abilities of our translator to negotiate that situation in a way that did not make Lena's family lose faith and did not make us look like terrible family members who don't participate in the family the way Chinese families would. And I think that that's not an uncommon thing that would happen, because I think people in rural China think Americans are very wealthy.
And comparatively, we are very wealthy. I mean,
absolutely.
We can set aside $10,000 every 2 years to go visit them. But, you know, what they don't need to know is that occurs with considerable budgeting and impact on how we live our lives. And so, asking for an additional bucket of money is not achievable for us. And the way that Chinese people will handle that situation in their own family is they will not have a face-to-face confrontation. And so because we had expended resources finding the right translators, multiple, you know, they were able to explain the situation. It was not a face-to-face discussion. It was a way, and it's a situation that I'm comfortable with because I'm culturally Chinese and I understand how these things, had a better understanding, not a complete understanding as the Chinese native, but had a decent understanding of the better way to handle it. Is the translator explained the situation, they were able to step back from the request without losing face. And we never addressed and have never addressed
and will never
address that situation with them directly. And right. that is how Chinese people handle it. And that is the appropriate way to handle it. That's the professional way to handle it. And our translator handled it for us. And so if you don't have the right advice or resources, that would have ended the relationship.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. So they asked for money, the translator explained, and in a way that's also a kind of cultural education for them, that yes, it may seem like there's a lot of money here. And in
right.
well in term, you know, in terms of how the two lives look, but it's their opportunity to also, I guess, learn something in a subtle way about what your own limitations are and what sort of
right.
the realities
and
are. But
cultural,
it never becomes a face to face discussion.
It would be awful if it was
right.
I think that's a big example. That is one big example of the cultural like tension between our families that is always there on some level. And that, you know, they're Chinese people living in China with Chinese lives. They don't have any reason except for us to understand American culture. And so, like, I've even sat down with Lena's mother and father before and said, you know, she's growing up American. And we are teaching her as much as we can about Chinese culture. But she will grow up to be your American daughter. And she will be very different than your Chinese children in the relationships that she has with you. And we had a very interesting conversation once where they asked, one of Lena's aunts asked me, like, oh, when Lena grows up, will she go live with her husband's family? Or will she live, I can't remember why they were asking, but it was something like, will she live with you until she lives with her husband's family? And we said, no, in America, a successful parent wants their child to move out and live on their own. Mm-hmm. If your child lives with you as an adult, you failed as a parent. The talking that happened around that table when they understood I was saying that, and they said to me, oh, no, that's just because she's a girl. If it were your son, you would want him to live with you forever, right? And I said, no, like, that would be worse. It would be so much worse if my son was living at home and he's 30. He really needs to be self-supporting and live out on his own.
Right. Here in America, what happens is we get old and we go live in an old person's home. And our children live across the country from us. So in a way.
I mean, I'll tell you, that was one of the funniest conversations we ever had with them, where they just could not understand. And I was like, no, we're failures. If our children never move out, we have failed. And like, it was so funny. But also at the same time, I think we were all just looking at each other like we are from different planets. And I think her family, I think, they're thinking, how can we have a child like that? How can we have an American child who, you know, doesn't want to live with her parents? So it's a very interesting experience, but at the same time, we're asking a lot from them. You know, we're asking them to really go out of their comfort zone all the time to deal with us.
And they recognize, and I do think we know them well enough now, they recognize that, you know, this is a significant change in how we live our lives as well. And so, you know, we're all, you know, when this last visit, which just occurred a couple months ago, you know, there was the very clear sense is, you know, we are kind of all four of us walking hand in hand towards a future that no one knows what's going to happen. And so, you know, we're just committed to doing the best we can in the situation, which is a very positive situation, but we don't know, there's no model for us to go down.
Another thing that happened is that I think has always been in the back of my mind is early on we were having some bumpy conversations with them where we were not seeing eye to eye, and not in an argumentative way, but just weren't quite feeling comfortable. And I had a conversation with Lena's mom, her birth mom, and you know, we said, I can't remember who said it, but somebody said, you know, it's okay if we don't figure it all out right now. We have our whole lives to figure this out. And she has her whole life to get to know us and for us to get to know you. And and we're here, we're all in this for the long haul. Like, we're really in this together. And I think that when things get difficult, I think that each side has taken the opportunity to remind each other, no, we're really here for her forever, and even if it's hard. So I think that knowing that makes all of it a little more bearable, even when it's difficult.
Well, I think the image that, Robert leaves us with of the four of you walking hand in hand into the future is a very beautiful image. I do want to say this, that I did ask if Lena's birth parents would want to participate in this discussion and be interviewed, and they've opted not to do that, even if they weren't identified. And I was wondering if you could just tell us why. What's their thinking about?
Well, we asked them on the phone, on our last phone call, and Lena's Baba initially agreed, and we told him, you know, we really want you to think about it. We'd like it if you do it, but it won't affect our relationship with you, obviously. But we explained that there's a lot of adoptees in America who have these questions about what were their birth parents thinking and what were the things that led them to make the choices not to parent their children. And that was why we chose to do the interview. And we had our translator go back and talk to him about 2 weeks later. And he had talked to Lena's mama, who had not been on the same phone call. They were separated in place at that time. And I think they came back and said that they just weren't comfortable doing it. They just feel so sad about what happened to Lena. And they feel ashamed of their choices. And I think they're just not comfortable right now being public. You know, they're just private people anyway. You know, they're rural people. And I think that they're just, there's a lot of shame there about their situation. You know, while there's a lot of love for Lena and acceptance of the openness in our adoption now, I think that that doesn't erase the fact that, you know, their parents who chose not to parent their child, and their hearts are broken about that. You know, they're ashamed of it and they're sad.
It's not surprising the decision they made, you know, to go from, you know, not even discussing it internally in the family to, you know, discussed openly and comfortably internally in the family. And now, you know, we've taken another step where everyone in the village knows, everyone in the village knows us. You know, everyone in the village refers to Lena as a village girl when she's there. You know, that is, you know, widening the circle a little bit. And, you know, a conversation with your website, Jenna, is widening that circle to the whole globe. And so, you know, they may change their mind later on, you know, if they get more exposure to this idea. But it's you know, everything is always a process. So you know, we are happy that they've been willing to go with us this far, and if they never go farther than this, you know, we have a relationship that's valuable and worthwhile. So we'll see what happens.
I just wanted to say, too, we did tell them we were doing this, and they said it was fine. So they know we're sharing our side of their story. So it's not like we're doing this behind their back or anything. So they know that we're continuing to go forward, even though they chose not to.